Remarkably good judgment, says Finnick. With one hand he reaches into the water and scoops out Mags, like she weighs no more than a puppy. She makes some remark that I think includes the word Bob, then pats her belt.
Look, she's right. Someone figured it out,
Finnick points to Beatty. He's flailing around in the waves, but managing to keep his head above water. What? I say.
The belts, they're flotation devices, says Finnick. I mean, you have to propel yourself, but they'll keep you from drowning.
I almost ask Finnick to wait, to get Beatty and Wyrus, and take them with us, but Beatty's three spokes over, and I can't even see Wyrus. For all I know, Finnick would kill them as quickly as he did the tribute from Five, so instead I suggest we move on. I hand Peter a bow, a sheath of arrows, and a knife, keeping the rest for myself. But Mags tugs on my sleeve and babbles on until I've given the all to her. Pleased, she clamps the handle between her gums and reaches her arms up to Finnick. He tosses his net over his shoulder, hoists Mags on top of it, grips his tridents in his free hand, and we run away from the cornucopia. Where the sand ends, woods begin to rise sharply. No, not really woods, at least not the kind I know. Jungle, the foreign, almost obsolete word comes to mind. Something I heard from another Hunger Games or learned from my father. Most of the trees are unfamiliar, with smooth trunks and few branches. The earth is very black and spongy underfoot, often obscured by tangles of vines with colorful blossoms. While the sun's hot and bright, the air's warm and heavy with moisture, and I get the feeling I will never really be dry here. The thin blue fabric of my jumpsuit lets the seawater evaporate easily, but it's already begun to cling to me with sweat. Peter takes the lead, cutting through the patches of dense vegetation with his long knife. I make Finnick go second, because even though he's the most powerful, he's got his hands full with Mags. Besides, while he's a whiz with that trident, it's a weapon less suited to the jungle than my arrows. It doesn't take long, between the steep incline and the heat, to become short of breath. Peter and I have been training intensely, though, and Finnick's such an amazing physical specimen that even with Mags over his shoulder, we climb rapidly for about a mile before he requests a rest. And then I think it's more for Mag's sake than his own. The foliage has hidden the wheel from sight, so I scale a tree with rubbery limbs to get a better view, and then wish that I hadn't. Around the cornucopia, the ground appears to be bleeding. The water has purple stains. Bodies lie on the ground and float in the sea. But at this distance, with everyone dressed exactly the same, I can't tell who lives or dies. All I can tell is that some of the tiny blue figures still battle. Well, what did I think? That the victor's chain of locked hands last night would result in some sort of universal truce in the arena? No, I never believed that. But I guess I had hoped people might show some, what, restraint? Reluctance, at least, before they jumped right into massacre mode. And you all knew each other, I think. You acted like friends. I have only one real friend in here, and he isn't from District 4. I let the slight, soupy breeze cool my cheeks while I come to a decision. Despite the bangle, I should just get it over with and shoot Finnick. There's really no future in this alliance, and he's too dangerous to let go. Now, when we have this tentative trust, may be my only chance to kill him. I could easily shoot him in the back as we walk. It's despicable, of course, but will it be any more despicable if I wait, know him better, owe him more? No, this is the time. I take one last look at the battling figures, the bloody ground, to harden my resolve, and then slide to the ground. But when I land, I find Finnick's kept pace with my thoughts, as if he knows what I have seen and how it will have affected me.
He has one of his tridents raised in a casually defensive position.
"What's going on down there, Katniss? Have they all joined hands, taken a vow of non-violence, tossed the weapons in the sea in defiance of the capital?" Finnick asks.
"No," I say.
"No?" Finnick repeats. "Because whatever happened in the past is in the past, and no one in this arena was a victor by chance."
He eyes Peeta for a moment.
"Except maybe Peeta."
Finnick knows then what Haymitch and I know about Peeta being truly, deep down, better than the rest of us. Finnick took out that tribute from Five without blinking an eye, and how long did I take to turn deadly? I shot to kill when I targeted Inobaria and Gloss and Brutus.
Peeta would at least have attempted negotiations first, seen if some wider alliance was possible. But to what end?
Finnick's right.
I'm right.
The people in this arena weren't crowned for their compassion. I hold his gaze, weighing his speed against my own. The time it will take to send an arrow through his brain versus the time his trident will reach my body. I can see him waiting for me to make the first move, calculating if he should block first or go directly for an attack. I can feel we've both about worked it out when Peeta steps deliberately between us.
"So how many are dead?" he asks.
"Move, you idiot," I think, but he remains planted firmly between us.
"Hard to say," I answer. "At least six, I think, and they're still fighting."
"Let's keep moving. We need water," he says.
So far, there's been no sign of a freshwater stream or pond, and the salt water's undrinkable. Again, I think of the last games, where I nearly died of dehydration.
"Better find some soon," says Finnick. "We need to be undercover when the others come hunting us tonight."
"We? Us? Hunting? All right. Maybe killing Finnick would be a little premature. He's been helpful so far. He does have Haymitch's stamp of approval, and who knows what the night will hold. If worse comes to worst, I can always kill him in his sleep. So I let the moment pass, and so does Finnick. The absence of water intensifies my thirst. I keep a sharp eye out as we continue our trek upward, but with no luck. After about another mile, I can see an end to the tree line and assume we're reaching the crest of the hill. Maybe we'll have better luck on the other side, find a spring or something. But there is no other side. I know this before anyone else, even though I am farthest from the top. My eyes catch on a funny rippling square, hanging like a warped pane of glass in the air. At first, I think it's the glare from the sun or the heat shimmering up off the ground, but it's fixed in space, not shifting when I move. And that's when I connect the square with Wyrus and Beatty in the training center and realize what lies before us. My warning cry is just reaching my lips when Peeta's knife swings out to slash away some vines. There's a sharp zapping sound. For an instant, the trees are gone, and I see open space over a short stretch of bare earth. Then Peeta's flung back from the force field, bringing Finnick and Mags to the ground. I rush over to where he lies, motionless in a web of vines.
"Peeta!"
There's a faint smell of singed hair. I call his name again, giving him a little shake, but he's unresponsive. My fingers fumble across his lips, where there's no warm breath, although moments ago he was panting. I press my ear against his chest, to the spot where I always rest my head, where I know I will hear the strong and steady beat of his heart. Instead, I find silence.
Chapter 20.
"Peeta!"
I scream. I shake him harder, even resort to slapping his face, but it's no use. His heart has failed. I am slapping emptiness.
"Peeta!"
Finnick props Mags against a tree and pushes me out of the way.
Let me.
His fingers touch points at Peeta's neck, run over the bones in his ribs and spine. Then he pinches Peeta's nostrils shut.
No!
I yell, hurling myself at Finnick, for surely he intends to make certain that Peeta's dead, to keep any hope of life from returning to him. Finnick's hand comes up and hits me so hard, so squarely in the chest, that I go flying back into a nearby tree trunk. I'm stunned for a moment by the pain, by trying to regain my wind, as I see Finnick close off Peeta's nose again. From where I sit, I pull an arrow, whip the notch into place, and am about to let it fly, when I'm stopped by the sight of Finnick kissing Peeta. And it's so bizarre, even for Finnick, that I stay my hand. No, he's not kissing him. He's got Peeta's nose blocked off, but his mouth tilted open, and he's blowing air into his lungs. I can see this. I can actually see Peeta's chest rising and falling. Then Finnick unzips the top of Peeta's jumpsuit and begins to pump the spot over his heart with the heels of his hands. Now that I've gotten through my shock, I understand what he's trying to do. Once in a blue moon, I've seen my mother try something similar, but not too often. If your heart fails in District 12, it's unlikely your family could get you to my mother in time anyway. So her usual patients are burned or wounded or ill, or starving, of course. But Finnick's world is different. Whatever he's doing, he's done it before. There's a very set rhythm and method, and I find the arrow tip sinking to the ground as I lean in to watch, desperately, for some sign of success. Agonizing minutes drag past as my hopes diminish. Around the time that I am deciding it's too late, that Peeta's dead, moved on, unreachable forever, he gives a small cough, and Finnick sits back. I leave my weapons in the dirt as I fling myself at him.
Peeta,
I say softly. I brush the damp blonde strands of hair back from his forehead, find the pulse drumming against my fingers at his neck. His lashes flutter open and his eyes meet mine.
Careful, he says weakly. There's a force field up ahead.
I laugh, but there are tears running down my cheeks.
Must be a lot stronger than the one on the training center roof, he says. I'm all right, though, just a little shaken.
You are dead! Your heart stopped! I burst out, before really considering if this is a good idea. I clap my hand over my mouth, because I'm starting to make those awful choking sounds that happen when I sob.
Well, it seems to be working now, he says.
It's all right, Katniss. I nod my head, but the sounds aren't stopping.
Katniss!
Now Peeta's worried about me, which adds to the insanity of it all.
It's okay. It's just her hormones, says Finnick. From the baby?
I look up and see him, sitting back on his knees, but still panting a bit from the climb and the heat and the effort of bringing Peeta back from the dead.
No, it's not!
I get out, but I'm cut off by an even more hysterical round of sobbing that seems only to confirm what Finnick said about the baby. He meets my eyes, and I glare at him through my tears. It's stupid, I know, that his efforts make me so vexed. All I wanted was to keep Peeta alive, and I couldn't, and Finnick could, and I should be nothing but grateful, and I am, but I'm also furious, because it means that I will never stop owing Finnick O'Dare, ever. So how can I kill him in his sleep? I expect to see a smug or sarcastic expression on his face, but his look is strangely quizzical. He glances between Peeta and me, as if trying to figure something out, then gives his head a slight shake as if to clear it.
How are you? He asks Peeta. Do you think you can move on?
No, he has to rest, I say. My nose is running like crazy, and I don't even have a shred of fabric to use as a handkerchief. Mags rips off a handful of hanging moss from a tree limb and gives it to me. I'm too much of a mess to even question it. I blow my nose loudly and mop the tears off my face. It's nice, the moss, absorbent and surprisingly soft. I notice a gleam of gold on Peeta's chest. I reach out and retrieve the disc that hangs from a chain around his neck. My mockingjay has been engraved on it. Is this your token? I ask. Yes. Do you mind that I used your mockingjay? I wanted us to match, he says.
No, of course I don't mind.
I force a smile. Peeta showing up in the arena wearing a mockingjay is both a blessing and a curse. On the one hand, it should give a boost to the rebels in the district. On the other, it's hard to imagine President Snow will overlook it, and that makes the job of keeping Peeta alive harder.
So you want to make camp here, then? Finnick asks. I don't think that's an option, Peeta answers. Staying here, with no water, no protection? I feel all right, really. If we could just go slowly.
Slowly would be better than not at all.
Finnick helps Peeta to his feet, while I pull myself together. Since I got up this morning, I've watched Cinna beaten to a pulp, landed in another arena, and seen Peeta die. Still, I'm glad Finnick keeps playing the pregnancy card for me, because from a sponsor's point of view, I'm not handling things all that well. I check over my weapons, which I know are in perfect condition, because it makes me seem more in control.
I'll take the lead, I announce.
Peeta starts to object, but Finnick cuts him off.
No, let her do it.
He frowns at me.
You knew that force field was there, didn't you? Right at the last second, you started to give warning.
I nod.
How did you know?
I hesitate. To reveal that I know Beatty and Wyrus's trick of recognizing a force field could be dangerous. I don't know if the game makers made note of that moment during training when the two pointed it out to me or not. One way or the other, I have a very valuable piece of information, and if they know I have it, they might do something to alter the force field so I can't see the aberration anymore. So I lie.
I don't know. It's almost as if I could hear it. Listen.
We all become still. There's the sound of insects, birds, the breeze in the foliage.
I don't hear anything, says Peeta.
Yes, I insist. It's like when the fence around District 12 is on, only much, much quieter.
Everyone listens again, intently. I do too, although there's nothing to hear.
There, I say. Can't you hear it? It's coming from right where Peeta got shocked.
I don't hear it either, says Finnick. But if you do, by all means, take the lead.
I decide to play this for all it's worth.
That's weird, I say.
I turn my head from side to side as if puzzled. I can only hear it out of my left ear.
The one the doctor's reconstructed? Asks Peeta.
Yeah, I say, then give a shrug. Maybe they did a better job than they thought. You know, sometimes I do hear funny things on that side. Things you wouldn't ordinarily think have a sound, like insect wings or snow hitting the ground.
Perfect. Now all the attention will turn to the surgeons who fixed my deaf ear after the games last year, and they'll have to explain why I can hear like a bat.
You,
says Mags, nudging me forward, so I take the lead. Since we're to be moving slowly, Mags prefers to walk with the aid of a branch Finnick quickly fashions into a cane for her. He makes a staff for Peeta as well, which is good, because despite his protestations, I think all Peeta really wants to do is lie down. Finnick brings up the rear, so at least someone alert has our backs. I walk with the force field on my left, because that's supposed to be the side of my superhuman ear. But since that's all made up, I cut down a bunch of hard nuts that hang like grapes from a nearby tree and toss them ahead of me as I go. It's good I do, too, because I have a feeling I'm missing the patches that indicate the force field more often than I'm spotting them. Whenever a nut hits the force field, there's a puff of smoke before the nut lands, blackened and with a cracked shell, on the ground at my feet. After a few minutes, I become aware of a smacking sound behind me and turn to see Mags peeling the shell off one of the nuts and popping it in her already full mouth. "Mags!" I cry. "Spit that out! It could be poisonous!" She mumbles something and ignores me, licking her lips with apparent relish. I look to Finnick for help, but he just laughs.
"I guess we'll find out," he says.
I go forward, wondering about Finnick, who saved old Mags, but will let her eat strange nuts, who Haymitch has stamped with his seal of approval, who brought Peeta back from the dead. Why didn't he just let him die? He would have been blameless. I never would have guessed it was in his power to revive him. Why could he possibly have wanted to save Peeta? And why was he so determined to team up with me? Willing to kill me, too, if it comes to that, but leaving the choice of if we fight to me. I keep walking, tossing my nuts, sometimes catching a glimpse of the force field, trying to press to the left to find a spot where we can break through, get away from the cornucopia, and hopefully find water. But after another hour or so of this, I realize it's futile. We're not making any progress to the left. In fact, the force field seems to be herding us along a curved path. I stop and look back at Mags's limping form, the sheen of sweat on Peeta's face. "Let's take a break," I say. "I need to get another look from above." The tree I choose seems to jut higher into the air than the others. I make my way up the twisting boughs, staying as close to the trunk as possible, no telling how easily these rubbery branches will snap. Still, I climb beyond good sense because there's something I have to see. As I cling to a stretch of trunk no wider than a sapling, swaying back and forth in the humid breeze, my suspicions are confirmed. There's a reason we can't turn to the left. We'll never be able to. From this precarious vantage point, I can see the shape of the whole arena for the first time, a perfect circle, with a perfect wheel in the middle. The sky above the circumference of the jungle is tinged a uniform pink, and I think I can make out one or two of those wavy squares, chinks in the armor, Wyrus and Beatty called them, because they reveal what was meant to be hidden and are therefore a weakness. Just to make absolutely sure, I shoot an arrow into the empty space above the tree line. There's a spurt of light, a flash of real blue sky, and the arrow's thrown back into the jungle. I climb down to give the others the bad news. The force field has us trapped in a circle, a dome, really. I don't know how high it goes. There's the cornucopia, the sea, and then the jungle all around. Very exact, very symmetrical, and not very large, I say.
"Did you see any water?" asks Finnick.
"Only the salt water where we started the games," I say.
"There must be some other source," says Peeta, frowning, "or we'll all be dead in a matter of days."
"Well, the foliage is thick. Maybe there are ponds or springs somewhere," I say doubtfully. I instinctively feel the capital might want these unpopular games over as soon as possible. Plutarch Heavensby might have already been given the orders to knock us off. At any rate, there's no point in trying to find out what's over the edge of this hill, because the answer is nothing.
"There must be drinkable water between the force field and the wheel," Peeta insists.
We all know what this means, heading back down. Heading back to the careers and the bloodshed, with Mags hardly able to walk and Peeta too weak to fight. We decide to move down the slope a few hundred yards and continue circling. See if maybe there's some water at that level. I stay in the lead, occasionally chucking a nut to my left, but we're well out of range of the force field now,
The sun beats down on us, turning the air to steam, playing tricks on our eyes. By mid-afternoon, it's clear Peeta and Mags can't go on. Finnick chooses a campsite about 10 yards below the force field, saying we can use it as a weapon by deflecting our enemies into it if attacked. Then he and Mags pull blades of the sharp grass that grows in 5-foot-high tufts and begin to weave them together into mats. Since Mags seems to have no ill effects from the nuts, Peeta collects bunches of them and fries them by bouncing them off the force field. He methodically peels off the shells, piling the meats on a leaf. I stand guard, fidgety and hot, and raw with the emotions of the day. Thirsty. I am so thirsty. Finally, I can't stand it anymore. Finnick, why don't you stand guard and I'll hunt around some more for water, I say. No one's thrilled with the idea of me going off alone, but the threat of dehydration hangs over us. Don't worry, I won't go far, I promise Peeta.
I'll go too, he says.
No, I'm going to do some hunting if I can, I tell him. I don't add, and you can't come because you're too loud. But it's implied. He would both scare off prey and endanger me with his heavy tread. I won't be long. I move stealthily through the trees, happy to find that the ground lends itself to soundless footsteps. I work my way down at a diagonal, but I find nothing except more lush green plant life. The sound of the cannon brings me to a halt. The initial bloodbath at the cornucopia must be over. The death toll of the tributes is now available. I count the shots, each representing one dead victor. 8. Not as many as last year, but it seems like more since I know most of their names. Suddenly weak, I lean against a tree to rest, feeling the heat draw the moisture from my body like a sponge. Already swallowing is difficult, and fatigue is creeping up on me. I try rubbing my hand across my belly, hoping some sympathetic pregnant woman will become my sponsor and Haymitch could send in some water. No luck. I sink to the ground. In my stillness, I begin to notice the animals, strange birds with brilliant plumage, tree lizards with flickering blue tongues, and something that looks like a cross between a rat and a possum clinging on to the branches close to the trunk. I shoot one of the latter out of a tree to get a closer look. It's ugly, all right, a big rodent with a fuzz of mottled gray fur and 2 wicked-looking gnawing teeth protruding over its lower lip. As I'm gutting and skinning it, I notice something else. Its muzzle is wet, like an animal that's been drinking from a stream. Excited, I start at its home tree and move slowly out in a spiral. It can't be far, the creature's water source. Nothing. I find nothing. Not so much as a dewdrop. Eventually, because I know Peeta will be worried about me, I head back to the camp, hotter and more frustrated than ever. When I arrive, I see the others have transformed the place. Mags and Finnick have created a hut of sorts out of the grass mats, open on one side, but with 3 walls, a floor and a roof. Mags has also plated several bowls that Peeta has filled with roasted nuts. Their faces turn to me hopefully, but I give my head a shake. No, no water. It's out there, though. He knew where it was, I say, hoisting the skinned rodent up for all to see. He'd been drinking recently when I shot him out of a tree, but I couldn't find his source. I swear I covered every inch of ground in a 30-yard radius. Can we eat him? Peeta asks. I don't know for sure, but his meat doesn't look that different from a squirrel's. He ought to be cooked. I hesitate as I think of trying to start a fire out here from complete scratch. Even if I succeed, there's the smoke to think about. We're all so close together in this arena, there's no chance of hiding it. Peeta has another idea. He takes a cube of rodent meat, skewers it on the tip of a pointed stick,
and lets it fall into the force field. There's a sharp sizzle, and the stick flies back. The chunk of meat is blackened on the outside, but well-cooked inside. We give him a round of applause, then quickly stop, remembering where we are. The white sun sinks in the rosy sky as we gather in the hut. I'm still leery about the nuts, but Finnick says Mags recognized them from another games. I didn't bother spending time at the edible plant station in training because it was so effortless for me last year. Now I wish I had, for surely there would have been some of the unfamiliar plants surrounding me, and I might have guessed a bit more about where I was headed. Mags seems fine, though, and she's been eating the nuts for hours. So I pick one up and take a small bite. It has a mild, slightly sweet flavor that reminds me of a chestnut. I decide it's all right. The rodent's strong and gamey, but surprisingly juicy. Really, it's not a bad meal for our first night in the arena, if only we had something to wash it down with. Finnick asks a lot of questions about the rodent, which we decide to call a tree rat. How high was it? How long? Did I watch it before I shot? And what was it doing? I don't remember it doing much of anything, snuffling around for insects or something. I'm dreading the night. At least the tightly woven grass offers some protection from whatever slinks across the jungle floor after hours. But a short time before the sun slips below the horizon, a pale white moon rises, making things just visible enough. Our conversation trails off because we know what's coming. We position ourselves in a line at the mouth of the hut, and Peeta slips his hand into mine. The sky brightens when the seal of the capital appears as if floating in space. As I listen to the strains of the anthem, I think, it will be harder for Finnick and Mags. But it turns out to be plenty hard for me as well, seeing the faces of the 8 dead victors projected into the sky. The man from District 5, the one Finnick took out with his trident, is the first to appear. That means that all the tributes in 1 through 4 are alive. The 4 careers, Beatty and Wyrus, and of course, Mags and Finnick. The man from District 5 is followed by the male morphling from 6, Celia and Woof from 8, both from 9, the woman from 10, and Cedar from 11. The capital seal is back with a final bit of music, and then the sky goes dark except for the moon. No one speaks. I can't pretend I knew any of them well. But I'm thinking of those 3 kids hanging on to Cecilia when they took her away. Cedar's kindness to me at our meeting. Even the thought of the glazed-eyed morphling painting my cheeks with yellow flowers gives me a pang. All dead, all gone. I don't know how long we might have sat here if it weren't for the arrival of the silver parachute, which glides down through the foliage to land before us. No one reaches for it. "Whose is it, do you think?" I say finally.
"No telling," says Finnick. "Why don't we let Peeta claim it, since he died today?"
Peeta unties the cord and flattens out the circle of silk. On the parachute sits a small metal object that I can't place. "What is it?" I ask. No one knows. We pass it from hand to hand, taking turns examining it. It's a hollow metal tube, tapered slightly at one end. On the other end, a small lip curves downward. It's vaguely familiar, a part that could have fallen off a bicycle, a curtain rod, anything really. Peeta blows on one end to see if it makes a sound. It doesn't. Finnick slides his pinky into it, testing it out as a weapon. Useless. "Can you fish with it, Mags?" I ask. Mags, who can fish with almost anything, shakes her head and grunts. I take it and roll it back and forth on my palm. Since we're allies, Haymitch will be working with the District 4 mentors. He had a hand in choosing this gift. That means it's valuable, life-saving even. I think back to last year, when I wanted water so badly,
but he wouldn't send it because he knew I could find it if I tried. Haymitch's gifts, or lack thereof, carry weighty messages. I can almost hear him growling at me. Use your brain if you have one. What is it? I wipe the sweat from my eyes and hold the gift out in the moonlight. I move it this way and that, viewing it from different angles, covering portions and then revealing them, trying to make it divulge its purpose for me. Finally, in frustration, I jam one end into the dirt. I give up. Maybe if we hook up with Beatty and Wireless, they can figure it out. I stretch out, pressing my hot cheek on the grass mat, staring at the thing in aggravation. Peter rubs a tense spot between my shoulders, and I let myself relax a little. I wonder why this place hasn't cooled off at all now that the sun's gone down. I wonder what's going on back home. Prim, my mother, Gail, Madge, I think of them watching me from home. At least I hope they're at home, not taken into custody by Thread, being punished as Cinna is, as Darius is, punished because of me, everybody. I begin to ache for them, for my district, for my woods, a decent woods with sturdy hardwood trees, plentiful food, game that isn't creepy, rushing streams, cool breezes, no, cold winds to blow the stifling heat away. I conjure up such a wind in my mind, letting it freeze my cheeks and numb my fingers, and all at once, the piece of metal half buried in the black earth has a name. A spile, I exclaim, sitting bolt upright. What? Asks Finnick. I wrestle the thing from the ground and brush it clean, cut my hand around the tapered end, concealing it, and look at the lip. Yes, I've seen one of these before, on a cold, windy day long ago when I was out in the woods with my father. Inserted snugly into a hole drilled in the side of a maple, a pathway for the sap to follow as it flowed into our bucket. Maple syrup could make even our dull bread a treat. After my father died, I didn't know what happened to the handful of spiles he had, hidden out in the woods somewhere, probably never to be found. It's a spile, sort of like a faucet. You put it in a tree and sap comes out. I look at the sinewy green trunks around me. Well, the right sort of tree. Sap? Asks Finnick. They don't have the right kind of trees by the sea either. To make syrup, says Peter. But there must be something else inside these trees. We're all on our feet at once. Our thirst, the lack of springs, the tree rat's sharp front teeth and wet muzzle. There can only be one thing worth having inside these trees. Finnick goes to hammer the spile into the green bark of a massive tree with a rock, but I stop him. Wait, you might damage it. We need to drill a hole first, I say. There's nothing to drill with, so Mags offers her awl, and Peeta drives it straight into the bark, burying the spike 2 inches deep. He and Finnick take turns opening up the hole with the awl and the knives until it can hold the spile. I wedge it in carefully, and we all stand back in anticipation. At first, nothing happens. Then a drop of water rolls down the lip and lands in Mags's palm. She licks it off and holds out her hand for more. By wriggling and adjusting the spile, we get a thin stream running out. We take turns holding our mouths under the tap, wetting our parched tongues. Mags brings over a basket, and the grass is so tightly woven it holds water. We fill the basket and pass it around, taking deep gulps and later luxuriously splashing our faces clean. Like everything here, the water's on the warm side, but this is no time to be picky. Without our thirst to distract us, we're all aware of how exhausted we are and make preparations for the night. Last year, I always tried to have my gear ready in case I had to make a speedy retreat in the night. This year, there's no backpack to prepare, just my weapons,
which won't leave my grasp anyway. Then I think of the spile and wrest it from the tree trunk. I strip a tough vine of its leaves, thread it through the hollow center, and tie the spile securely to my belt. Finnick offers to take the first watch, and I let him, knowing it has to be one of the two of us until Peter's rested up. I lie down beside Peter on the floor of the hut, telling Finnick to wake me when he's tired. Instead, I find myself jarred from sleep a few hours later by what seems to be the tolling of a bell. Bong, bong. It's not exactly like the one they ring in the Justice Building on New Year's, but close enough for me to recognize it. Peter and Mags sleep through it, but Finnick has the same look of attentiveness I feel. The tolling stops. I counted 12, he says. I nod. 12. What does that signify? One ring for each district? Maybe. But why? Mean anything, do you think? No idea, he says. We wait for further instructions, maybe a message from Claudius Templesmith, an invitation to a feast. The only thing of note appears in the distance. A dazzling bolt of electricity strikes a towering tree, and then a lightning storm begins. I guess it's an indication of rain, of a water source for those who don't have mentors as smart as Haymitch. Go to sleep, Finnick. It's my turn to watch anyway, I say. Finnick hesitates, but no one can stay awake forever. He settles down at the mouth of the hut, one hand gripped around a trident, and drifts into a restless sleep. I sit with my bow loaded, watching the jungle, which is ghostly pale and green in the moonlight. After an hour or so, the lightning stops. I can hear the rain coming in, though, pattering on the leaves a few hundred yards away. I keep waiting for it to reach us, but it never does. The sound of the cannon startles me, although it makes little impression on my sleeping companions. There's no point in awakening them for this, another victor dead. I don't even allow myself to wonder who it is. The elusive rain shuts off suddenly, like the storm did last year in the arena. Moments after it stops, I see the fog sliding softly in from the direction of the recent downpour. Just a reaction. Cool rain on the steaming ground, I think. It continues to approach at a steady pace. Tendrils reach forward and then curl like fingers, as if they are pulling the rest behind them. As I watch, I feel the hairs on my neck begin to rise. Something's wrong with this fog. The progression of the front line is too uniform to be natural. And if it's not natural, a sickeningly sweet odor begins to invade my nostrils, and I reach for the others, shouting for them to wake. In the few seconds it takes to rouse them, I begin to blister. Chapter 21. Tiny, searing stabs, wherever the droplets of mist touch my skin. Run! I scream at the others. Run! Finnick snaps awake instantly, rising to counter an enemy. But when he sees the wall of fog, he tosses a still-sleeping Mags onto his back and takes off. Peter is on his feet, but not as alert. I grab his arm and begin to propel him through the jungle after Finnick. What is it? What is it? He says in bewilderment. Some kind of fog, poisonous gas. Hurry, Peter! I urge. I can tell that however much he denied it during the day, the after effects of hitting the force field have been significant. He's slow, much slower than usual. And the tangle of vines and undergrowth, which unbalance me occasionally, trip him at every step. I look back at the wall of fog extending in a straight line as far as I can see in either direction. A terrible impulse to flee, to abandon Peter and save myself, shoots through me. It would be so simple,
to run full out, perhaps to even climb a tree above the fog line, which seems to top out at about 40 feet. I remember how I did just this when the Matatians appeared in the last games, took off, and only thought of Peeta when I'd reached the cornucopia. But this time, I'd trap my terror, push it down, and stay by his side. This time, my survival isn't the goal. Peeta's is. I think of the eyes glued to the television screens in the districts, seeing if I will run, as the capital wishes, or hold my ground. I lock my fingers tightly into his and say, "Watch my feet. Just try to step where I step." It helps. We seem to move a little faster, but never enough to afford a rest, and the mist continues to lap at our heels. Droplets spring free of the body of vapor. They burn, but not like fire. Less a sense of heat and more of intense pain as the chemicals find our flesh, cling to it, and burrow down through the layers of skin. Our jumpsuits are no help at all. We may as well be dressed in tissue paper for all the protection they give. Finnick, who bounded off initially, stops when he realizes we're having problems. But this is not a thing you can fight, only evade. He shouts encouragement, trying to move us along, and the sound of his voice acts as a guide, though little more. Peeta's artificial leg catches in a knot of creepers, and he sprawls forward before I can catch him. As I help him up, I become aware of something scarier than the blisters, more debilitating than the burns. The left side of his face has sagged, as if every muscle in it has died. The lid droops, almost concealing his eye. His mouth twists in an odd angle toward the ground. "Peeta," I begin, and that's when I feel the spasms run up my arm. Whatever chemical laces the fog does more than burn. It targets our nerves. A whole new kind of fear shoots through me, and I yank Peeta forward, which only causes him to stumble again. By the time I get him to his feet, both of my arms are twitching uncontrollably. The fog has moved in on us, the body of it less than a yard away. Something is wrong with Peeta's legs. He's trying to walk, but they move in a spastic, puppet-like fashion. I feel him lurch forward and realize Finnick has come back for us and is hauling Peeta along. I wedge my shoulder, which still seems under my control, under Peeta's arm and do my best to keep up with Finnick's rapid pace. We put about 10 yards between us and the fog when Finnick stops. "It's no good. I'll have to carry him. Can you take Mags?" he asks me. "Yes," I say stoutly, although my heart sinks. It's true that Mags can't weigh more than about 70 pounds, but I'm not very big myself. Still, I'm sure I've carried heavier loads. If only my arms would stop jumping around. I squat down, and she positions herself over my shoulder, the way she rides on Finnick. I slowly straighten my legs, and with my knees locked, I can manage her. Finnick has Peeta slung across his back now, and we move forward, Finnick leading, me following in the trail he breaks through the vines. On the fog comes, silent and steady and flat, except for the grasping tendrils. Although my instinct is to run directly away from it, I realize Finnick is moving at a diagonal down the hill. He's trying to keep a distance from the gas while steering us toward the water that surrounds the cornucopia. "Yes, water," I think, as the acid droplets bore deeper into me. Now I'm so thankful I didn't kill Finnick, because how would I have gotten Peeta out of here alive? So thankful to have someone else on my side, even if it's only temporarily. It's not Mags's fault when I begin falling. She's doing everything she can to be an easy passenger, but the fact is, there is only so much weight I can handle, especially now that my right leg seems to be going stiff. The first 2 times I crashed to the ground, I managed to make it back on my feet. But the 3rd time, I cannot get my legs to cooperate. As I struggle to get up, it gives out, and Mags rolls off onto the ground before me.
I flail around, trying to use vines and trunks to right myself. Finnick's back by my side, Peeta hanging over him.
It's no use, I say. Can you take them both? Go on ahead, I'll catch up.
A somewhat doubtful proposal, but I say it with as much surety as I can muster. I can see Finnick's eyes, green in the moonlight. I can see them as clear as day, almost like a cat's, with a strange reflective quality, maybe because they are shiny with tears.
No, he says, I can't carry them both. My arms aren't working.
It's true. His arms jerk uncontrollably at his sides. His hands are empty. Of his three tridents, only one remains, and it's in Peeta's hands.
I'm sorry, Mags. I can't do it.
What happens next is so fast, so senseless, I can't even move to stop it. Mags hauls herself up, plants a kiss on Finnick's lips, and then hobbles straight into the fog. Immediately, her body is seized by wild contortions, and she falls to the ground in a horrible dance. I want to scream, but my throat is on fire. I take one futile step in her direction when I hear the cannon blast. No, her heart has stopped, that she is dead.
Finnick!
I call out hoarsely, but he has already turned from the scene, already continued his retreat from the fog. Dragging my useless leg behind me, I stagger after him, having no idea what else to do. Time and space lose meaning as the fog seems to invade my brain, muddling my thoughts, making everything unreal. Some deep-rooted animal desire for survival keeps me stumbling after Finnick and Peeta, continuing to move, although I'm probably dead already. Parts of me are dead, or clearly dying, and Mags is dead. This is something I know, or maybe just think I know, because it makes no sense at all. Moonlight glinting on Finnick's bronze hair, beads of searing pain peppering me, a leg turned to wood. I follow Finnick until he collapses on the ground, Peeta still on top of him. I seem to have no ability to stop my own forward motion and simply propel myself onward until I trip over their prone bodies, just one more on the heap. This is where and how and when we all die, I think. But the thought is abstract and far less alarming than the current agonies of my body. I hear Finnick groan and manage to drag myself off the others. Now I can see the wall of fog, which has taken on a pearly white quality. Maybe it's my eyes playing tricks or the moonlight, but the fog seems to be transforming. Yes, it's becoming thicker, as if it has pressed up against a glass window and is being forced to condense. I squint harder and realize the fingers no longer protrude from it. In fact, it has stopped moving forward entirely. Like other horrors I have witnessed in the arena, it has reached the end of its territory. Either that or the game makers have decided not to kill us just yet.
It's stopped, I try to say, but only an awful croaking sound comes from my swollen mouth. It stopped,
I say again, and this time I must be clearer, because both Peeta and Finnick turn their heads to the fog. It begins to rise upward now, as if being slowly vacuumed into the sky. We watch until it has all been sucked away, and not the slightest wisp remains. Peeta rolls off Finnick, who turns over onto his back. We lie there, gasping, twitching, our minds and bodies invaded by the poison. After a few minutes pass, Peeta vaguely gestures upward.
Monkeys!
I look up and spot a pair of what I guess are monkeys. I have never seen a live monkey. There's nothing like that in our woods at home. But I must have seen a picture or one in the games, because when I see the creatures, the same word comes to my mind. I think these have orange fur, although it's hard to tell, and are about half the size of a full-grown human. I take the monkeys for a good sign. Surely they would not hang around if the air was deadly. For a while we quietly observe one another, humans and monkeys. Then Peter struggles to his knees and crawls down the slope. We all crawl, since walking now seems as remarkable a feat as flying. We crawl until the vines turn to a narrow strip of sandy beach, and the warm water that surrounds the cornucopia laps our faces. I jerk back as if I've touched an open flame, rubbing salt in a wound. For the first time, I truly appreciate the expression, because the salt in the water makes the pain of my wounds so blinding I nearly black out. But there's another sensation of drawing out. I experiment by gingerly placing only my hand in the water. Torturous, yes, but then less so. And through the blue layer of water, I see a milky substance leaching out of the wounds on my skin. As the whiteness diminishes, so does the pain. I unbuckle my belt and strip off my jumpsuit, which is little more than a perforated rag. My shoes and undergarments are inexplicably unaffected. Little by little, one small portion of a limb at a time, I soak the poison out of my wounds. Peter seems to be doing the same, but Finnick backed away from the water at first touch and lies face down on the sand, either unwilling or unable to purge himself. Finally, when I have survived the worst, opening my eyes underwater, sniffing water through my sinuses and snorting it out, and even gargling repeatedly to wash out my throat, I'm functional enough to help Finnick. Some feeling has returned to my leg, but my arms are still riddled with spasms. I can't drag Finnick into the water, and possibly the pain would kill him anyway, so I scoop up shaky handfuls and empty them on his fists. Since he's not underwater, the poison comes out of his wounds just as it went in wisps of fog that I take great care to steer clear of. Peter recovers enough to help me. He cuts away Finnick's jumpsuit. Somewhere he finds two shells that work much better than our hands do. We concentrate on soaking Finnick's arms first, since they have been so badly damaged, and even though a lot of white stuff pours out of them, he doesn't notice. He just lies there, eyes shut, giving an occasional moan. I look around with growing awareness of how dangerous a position we're in. It's night, yes, but this moon gives off too much light for concealment. We're lucky no one's attacked us yet. We could see them coming from the cornucopia, but if all four careers attacked, they'd overpower us. If they didn't spot us first, Finnick's moans would give us away soon. "We've got to get more of him into the water," I whisper. "But we can't put him in face first, not while he's in this condition." Peter nods to Finnick's feet. We each take one, pull him 180 degrees around, and start to drag him into the salt water. Just a few inches at a time. His ankles? Wait a few minutes. Up to his mid-calf? Wait. His knees? Clouds of white swirl out from his flesh, and he groans. We continue to detoxify him, bit by bit. What I find is that the longer I sit in the water, the better I feel. Not just my skin, but my brain and muscle control continue to improve. I can see Peter's face beginning to return to normal, his eyelid opening, the grimace leaving his mouth. Finnick slowly begins to revive, his eyes open, focus on us, and register awareness that he's being helped. I rest his head on my lap, and we let him soak about 10 minutes with everything immersed from the neck down. Peter and I exchange a smile as Finnick lifts his arms above the seawater. "There's just your head left, Finnick. That's the worst part, but you'll feel much better after if you can bear it," Peter says. We help him to sit up and let him grip our hands as he purges his eyes and nose and mouth. His throat is still too raw to speak. I'm going to try to tap a tree, I say. My fingers fumble at my belt and find the spile still hanging from its vine.
Let me make the hole first, says Peeta. You stay with him. You're the healer.
That's a joke, I think. But I don't say it out loud, since Finnick has enough to deal with. He got the worst of the